It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
There is war in this forest. Not a war that has been fought, or one that will be, but any war. And the enemies who struggle here do not exist unless we call them into being. This forest then, and all that happens now, is outside history. Only the unchanging shapes of fear and doubt and death are from our world. These soldiers that you see keep our language and our time, but have no other country but the mind.
Nobody's gonna cry for me later or cheer for me now. Nobody else is me. I know that. Who else but me is buried under the chain of everything I ever did? I didn't mean any of it. Thanks, General. Thanks. I'll take the tombstone if it's really mine.
Okay, hello everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? Is It Psycho? Is It Kubrick? I'm Paul Spitero, and joined by the usual Is It Psycho group, and that includes Mr. Sean Whalen.
Pleasure to be here.
Mr. Trey Hooks.
Hello, General.
And Mr. Blaine Dell.
Hello, everyone.
So if you've been listening, which I hope you have, as you were would be aware, we have created the offshoot to Is It Jaws, which we call Is It Psycho, which is dedicated to doing Alfred Hitchcock movies. And somewhere along the line, Blaine suggested, hey, why don't we try and do Stanley Kubrick's movies as well, which the other three of us enthusiastically signed on for. And just once again, by way of background, I do not have the level of knowledge of Stanley Kubrick movies that probably I should have as a film and movie buff. There's ones that I know and I've seen numerous times, and there are some that I've never seen. The one we're going to cover today, I had never even heard of that I can recall. And I do find Kubrick's movies to be very polarizing. I usually either like them a lot or I don't. And it's usually, there is very little in the way of in between. Once again, today we're here to look at Kubrick's first feature, which is called Fear and Desire, from 1952. I was completely unaware or unfamiliar with the existence of this movie until Blaine said this is the next one we're doing. And I've watched through twice, once just sitting and watching a version of it from a DVD, and once going on a... I don't know what service it's streaming on, but some service that it's streaming on, and it was a very, very bad colorized version, very early in the colorization process. I can say the colorization, despite how bad it is, did not really impact my opinion of the movie. But I'll say overall, I really didn't care for this one on an entertainment level. We'll leave it at that for now. Go around the room and see what everybody has on their first thoughts. Sean?
So I'm glad we're doing this series. I love film history. And I'm really glad I watched this from a film history standpoint. There are things I liked about this or admired about what was attempted here. I'll echo Paul in the sense that I felt this was a trudge to watch. But there was moments where I'm seeing an early director doing some really cool things. Like, so I would say from a film history standpoint, you should watch this from that perspective. A lot of my comments during this are going to contradict that thought process. But I want to be clear. I enjoyed the aspect of watching the piece of history from Stanley Kubrick. But I wasn't, and in particular, I will, we'll get to it as we get there. But I will say my initial impression of this one was, this was a bit of a trudge. I was actually looking at the time, which I watched 2.5 hour, 3 hour movies, and I haven't done that. This one, I'm like, are we getting there? Are we getting to the end of the film? And that type of thing, which is something that's, you guys, if you've listened to this for any period of time, that's not me. I've got pretty diverse tastes. And this one for me was, it was hard to get through.
And it's an hour long.
Yes, exactly.
I agree, Sean. What's the saying? One step forward, two steps back. Compared to the short films we watched, I felt like this was a step back.
Myself, I saw this to try and be the Kubrick completist, and this is in many ways what I would call a failed experiment. This feels like. It feels like the kind of product most filmmakers would make as a student in film school, but Kubrick didn't go to film school. So that experimental student film became a wide release. He actually tried to suppress it. In the rest of his career, he said this was like the crayon scratchings of a child on his mother's fridge. And he tried to purchase every known print and he burned them in his backyard to make sure they were gone. It's only after he passed, they found another copy, and it was found by a company who wasn't ready to honor those wishes. They realized, no, there's a market for this. It's Kubrick. We can sell this and make a ton. And when that happened, Kubrick's estate came in and said, yeah, these people are selling the DVD for like $60 US. So that, and it's not a very good quality. So then the copy I got was the one that came shortly thereafter when his estate said, okay, there's one copy left that we're aware of. It's in good shape. And they passed it on to the Kino Lorber people who made a Blu-ray and put it in the Library of Congress. And they did a great job. So that I've got the Kino Lorber Blu-ray, which is the best presentation of this film that's possible.
That's damning it with faint praise.
Yeah. Like I said, this is, I think Sean nailed it when he said, if you're a student of film history or of Kubrick himself, it's interesting to watch from that perspective. If you come to your movies for pure entertainment and you're not interested in how films are assembled, you probably want to skip it.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that for a second. I don't regret having watched it because I am interested in film history. And, you know, Kubrick is one of the reasons we're doing him is he's one of the significant names in film history. He's one of the significant architects of you know, film directing. And there's, you can see things in this that I guess are innovative for its time. But you also see a lot of, in my opinion, you see a lot in this that's experimental. There's a lot of extreme close-ups and things. I don't think he had a proper grasp of setting a scene and you know, when to give, you know, an establishing shot on many occasions. So, you know, I think the fact that he had such a limited budget at the time might have entered into some things he couldn't get as elaborate, you know. Historically, Kubrick is known for, you know, filming a scene to death, you know, doing whatever 100 takes on the same thing. He couldn't do that with this because he didn't have the budget to do it. So maybe that is a big factor in the amateurish feel of a lot of this. But I think, Blaine, you know, in my opinion, it did kind of fit with what you say, where it feels like a you know, a student film. It doesn't feel like a professional movie that should be released on, you know, on the big screen, maybe at a film festival somewhere, you know?
It's almost a Franken movie. And what I mean by that is I feel like he was a director who was aware of these different tricks and devices he had seen in different films, but he didn't know the right way to assemble them. So, for example, you've got the almost, you know, dragnet-like intro at the front that you would expect more from a noir film that doesn't really fit with the rest of the film, in my opinion. You've got the really long, almost stage-like monologue voiceovers trying to get across the state of mind. At this point, he definitely doesn't know how to do action. The fight in the shed was probably one of the was almost more theater stage kind of fighting than what you would expect in a film of the time.
And some of that, there's the great shots, or potentially great shots, where someone is punching the camera, so you get the feel of the person mm-hmm. on the ground being hit. Except, you know, it's set up so, like we said, he's punching the camera, but that means the actor can't put all the force behind a punch that would actually be behind the punch, because then he'd be wrecking the camera. So the punches don't land, if you pardon the pun there.
When it comes to the character development, it's almost too real. And mm-hmm. and what I mean by that is we're dropped in with these characters at a point in time where they're already tired. They're downtrodden because of war. And I get what he was going for there. He was trying to get gritty and real. And I thought some of that, there was a cutting edge attempt at showing a descent into madness for, you know, at least a couple of the characters with what was going on there. The problem with where he dropped us, though, I never cared about them. And that's a really critical piece. Like, you're asking, Sean, did you care about any of these characters? No. The performances were very wooden. And I never at any point in time, and this is me personally, I never cared about them, which is very unusual for me in a film to be able to say the team that I was supposed to be following, I didn't care about them enough that I was motivated to see them kill this general. I didn't differentiate them. Like, they were all in war. War sucks. And I mean, that's great. It's great messaging with what he was trying to portray there. But at some point in time, I should be motivated to say, I want to see them get the bad guy in the film. And I'm like, but what's different about him? Why do I care? And that was what I was constantly feeling in the film, was that I didn't like them. It's not, and I don't want to say I didn't like them. It almost sounds like I had an emotion about them. I was ambivalent. And I think that is the biggest mistake of this, is I never emotionally attached. But yet I felt like the idea of showing this, what the mental state is of people who have been in war as they're going through the process, I'm like, there's something brilliant that he's trying to do here. And I thought, in the early 50s, I'm like, there's a cutting edge idea here. And I admired that, but the execution just never stuck to the point where I got the impact that I should be from it.
I think the main problem with the film for me was Lieutenant Corby. He had this weird, like right from the start, he had this weird kind of mixture of laconic and sardonic and disaffected, to where it's like on the one hand, I could get it if they were trying to portray, I'm the pilot and, you know, I'm the pilot and I'm the commanding officer, and that makes me better than you guys, and I've got a chip on my shoulder because I'm better than you guys. But it wasn't really that. You would just kind of get this, well, I guess we've got to go down the river now. That's the way to, and you're just like, could you have some urgency about getting, you know, out of enemy territory? Yeah.
I didn't feel, you know, to Sean's point, I didn't feel that I was rooting for anybody in this movie. If there was one person I rooted for, it was the poor peasant girl who was in that situation. And I do think that's part of the message that they're sending is, you know, I think the message is war is hell and it's bad and all of this stuff. And, that, you know, that comes across, in fact, it comes across, I think, a little heavy-handed. And I wanted to give it some benefit of the doubt based on like the thought process that this is 1952, just because, you know, in 2026, I may see things from that far in the past and say, oh, that's, you know, not a cutting edge message. Well, maybe in 1952 it was, but I'm not really 100% sure it was. I think he does it maybe a little bit more gritty than you would see in that era. But I think war is hell was a common message, especially after World War II and during World War II. You know, they glamorized it a little bit to get people to want to serve the country and all of that. But I think by 1952, you know, after World War II was over, I think there had been enough films to say, hey, you know, this was really bad. And a lot of these people went through, you know, whatever and had PTSD, although they didn't call it that back then. So I can't give it the same credit for being cutting edge that I might for other films. This almost felt to me like it was inspired by Heart of Darkness, which eventually became Apocalypse Now, but had been written, I believe, in the 1920s about World War One. So I, you know, again, I'm not so sure it's as cutting edge as they want to make it, or as I want to give it credit for being.
Yeah, I think, I mean, well, Trey and I, on our 99 Years, 100 Films podcast, we've already talked about the original All Quiet on the Western Front, which sent that message loud and clear a good 20 years prior. I think where he did it here is his choice to have the actor who played Lieutenant Corby also play the opposing general. And the second in command of this was the same actor playing the second in command of this, to show that both sides really are the same and just war is war, which, I mean, to Paul's point, it may be a little heavy handed, but I would agree that the girl, and that's how she's credited, she never gets a name, but the girl who was tied to a tree was the only character I felt compelled to root for at any point in this film. All right, especially as Sydney is going down that crazy rabbit hole.
And the going down the crazy rabbit hole didn't feel as realistic and compelling. Like it just, the turn was too quick, I thought.
Yeah, I think to Sean's point, if anything, to improve this film, we need 30 minutes at the beginning to establish who these guys are, what they were like, you know, maybe give some glimpses of them before, maybe, you know, have it where Sydney joins the company, maybe because he's the youngest, maybe he's the least experienced, and see him go from normalcy to this. But, you know, it's, they, you know, he can go down that slope into madness. But when you start the film, when that skier is three quarters of the way down the slope, it's not as impressive.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. So, you know, I quite frankly, I don't have a lot on this movie because I didn't see things that I liked. and the things I didn't like almost feel overly simplistic.
Okay. Well, Sean, go ahead.
The girl's performance did stick out for me. I like her cold, dead stare, which I was kind of like, was this the first attempt at the Kubrick stare and that type of thing? I thought really worked. If it had just been left there, I would feel very differently about this. But we get that point where they're alone and he's gone and he's going too far with her. And he's downright creepy. I loved like the little nuances of her wrestling with her bonds, with her hands, her thinking through her head. If I play along, I can get to a point where I can take advantage of this. And I thought she did a lot of that, this without dialogue. She did all that through acting. And I mentioned wooden performances earlier. I want to pull back when it comes to her. I thought she had a great performance in this, in a movie where I was getting lost with everybody else. I thought she really didn't need the dialogue to do it. And I think that's harder to do when you're conveying a emotion, a sense of, to point of urgency. She was conveying it. And she was conveying a sneakiness and all these subtle pieces that we knew what she was doing at every point in time through action. And I thought that was very well handled. There's, like I said, there's some isolated bits in this that I thought were like really good. And that was one where he was so creepy that I was rooting for her. And I thought she did a great job of conveying desperation while at the same time showing she was intelligent and had a plan that was going there. I thought that that sequence, I thought her role in that was cool.
I agree. I really liked Frank Silvera. Mac was the one character whose motivations I got in terms of, you know, I felt like his obsession with the general was kind of that fatalistic, we're not going to make it. We're going to die here. It has to count for something. Mm-hmm. I would rather die trying to do this than get shot in the back going down the river.
I agree that I thought the girl's performance was more nuanced and that she kind of had ideas, and you could see as, you know, as it progressed, well, you know, why are you cutting her bonds? You know, you're really setting yourself up. And I kind of expected her to be more aggressive and try and kill him to escape rather than just run. So I was giving her credit for being a little bit more, I guess, calculating. But this was probably more realistic because she was probably in a total panic and just, you know, was being submissive to the, because she saw he was going to let her go. And as soon as he let her go, she, you know, taking off. So again, it's a nuanced performance, but I think ultimately what I come down to on this movie is I didn't care for the characters. The story didn't feel particularly compelling. Where the story takes us to didn't feel compelling. And it felt like it was put together kind of amateurishly. So except for the film history point of view, I just felt very let down by this movie.
To back up something that Trey said, I will say I agree with him that Frank Silvera, when he's going down the river in the raft, I think because of his performance, I loved that there was, he's kind of where everybody else is with the, you know, gone down to depths, but yet there was, it felt like there was emotional drive for him to get there. Like I said earlier, and I still stand behind it, I didn't really care whether or not they got the general. But in that sequence, I started caring about whether or not he lived, which he's the only character in this, I can say, that like I wanted to see him survive this in some capacity, especially when he comes across his crazy crewmate later. I'm like, don't let him on the raft. He might eat you. which I'm usually one like save the whole team, let's all get out together. I'm like, no, keep going because he's dangerous. You don't necessarily want him to go with you, and that's honestly the truth. He's definitely the only one out of the crew that I cared about if he survived. You're right, Trey. That's an interesting distinction because I do think that says something about his performance that I had some emotional attachment, but I didn't really with the others. Well, I don't care what happens to them. But I wanted to see him survive.
So I have a question for you, Blaine. You may know the answer to this. So there are two cuts of this film. There's a 70-minute, which was like, they call it the premiere cut, which was like what was shown at the theatrical premiere. And then it was cut down to the 60-minute mark. I never found anything like what was behind the cut. It was an independent film. So the producers would be, you know, Kubrick and the pharmacist who he got the money from, right? So do you know what was behind the later cut? I couldn't find anything like why he cut 10 minutes, and then, like, I know ultimately he still didn't like it and decided to burn it, but.
Yeah, the only thing I'm finding under the IMDb's alternate versions is that there is a release that has Day of the Flight and Flying Padre on the Blu-ray. My copy has The Seafarers, which is probably the better of the two. We already discussed it, but he made it later. And then there's, it's also available in a modern computer colored version, approximating the look of vintage Ted Turner style colorization. But this is, I'm not a fan of colorization in general. I wouldn't recommend it. So I don't know what content is in those 10 minutes. I would say watching this, his roots as a photographer rather than a storyteller shine through. Because we've got some beautiful photography. We've got some great imagery. We've got some good camera placement, but the narrative storytelling isn't there yet. And the thing with black and white versus color is you have very different lighting schema, right? You've got a different way to produce contrasts. In black and white, you're using your shadows to produce contrast. In color, you can use warm versus dark colors. And it's just, I have yet to see a colorized version of anything that I think is an improvement. It's just two wildly different types of filmmaking. And if a colorized version ever looks as good or better than the original, then to me, that's a sign of incompetence on the original cinematographer. This one has the cinematography. It struggles in the storytelling.
It's an interesting debate because we've talked about it in the past, and I am not opposed to colorization as a concept, but I can't argue with you that I don't know that I can talk about any film that I think is an improvement because it was colorized. I think there are some movies, especially in the current day and age where we have an audience that, you know, some portion of it is opposed to watching things in black and white. And, you know, I think that's a different audience than us, because I think as film fans, I think you naturally would be more open to the concept of black and white. And I do appreciate the aspect of it where you are using the shadows and using the light or lack thereof to create a mood and create an impression. I've pointed to It's a Wonderful Life when they did a good job, not the original Ted Turner version, of one where I didn't really feel like it detracted from the movie at all. I thought, and if, you know, if you had a problem with black and white, it would make it more accessible to an audience. And again, I'm not against it as a concept unless the film is, you know, I do have a problem with colorizing like film noir type movies, because the shadows are very, very significant in those movies.
This may be just a factor of the generation that we're all in, where I struggle with colorization is I'm so used to black and white for certain periods, it feels wrong. So like I know you've covered before, Paul, Babes in Toyland for, you know, or March of the Wooden Soldiers, whatever name, you know, they marketed under. Colorized Laurel and Hardy feels wrong to me, right? I'm a big Doctor Who fan, and lately they've been animating a lot of the missing episodes. When they release those, they'll have the animation in black and white and in color. And I watch the black and white animations because I'm just used to the episodes from that era being in black and white.
To the point of Doctor Who too, they recently recolorized one of the classic stories, and it was War Games, I think. Was
the War Games, yeah.
Yeah, and they did a great job on the colorization. So I want to say from a technical perspective, it was a great job. I was glad to see it, but I always prefer the original black and white, even in that case, because, and I think the key there is whether it's film or television or whatever, I think if you've got good directors, good writing, good script, if it was shot in black and white, there the mood, the tone, the everything is set for that type of environment. And when you colorize it, a lot of times that's lost because certain things are too bright. Like now all of a sudden we've got this splash of color where they never intended that. They wanted the shadows. They wanted the atmosphere and mood that was set there. And sometimes special effects take a hit when they're colorized as well. Whereas I find a lot of times black and white tends to hold up better because of the fact that it just there was an opportunity that directors were able to use to hide things, or to, you know, to use some trickery with the fact that it was black and white that I think you're exposing sometimes with the colorization. And I like seeing the original vision.
I think one of the most disturbing things to me in colorization is when they have part of the scene that's supposed to be dark and they choose to colorize 2/3 of the screen and then have the dark part still in kind of its black and white because they wanted it to be dark. But it doesn't look like a natural dark because of the colorization. And it stands out as a screen that has both color and black and white on, you know, showing. And I find that honestly takes me out of the film at that point. So, you know, I'm not sitting here as an advocate for colorizing movies. I'm saying, on the right film, it doesn't offend me. I guess that's the best I can do. I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. We did one of the Hitchcock movies, you know, one of the early Man on the Run movies. And there were some scenes in that where they were the long shots of the countryside, and I did think they were improved by the colorization because I saw it in both ones, and that's probably my best example of positive colorization, and it's really just for those scenes as opposed for the whole movie.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that the people who came up with colorization weren't pretending to improve the films. It's as Paul said, there's a segment of the audience who will not try to watch a black and white film, and they were just trying to reach that market.
So. And I applaud that, honestly, because I really wish that a younger audience would take in some of these movies and appreciate them and enjoy them. My stepdaughter's boyfriend, he surprised me because he was like, my favorite movie of all time is Casablanca. He's just turned 25. I mean, he's a kid. So that surprised me. And then he basically forced her to sit down and watch it because she would. I don't think she would ever watch a black and white movie otherwise. So I appreciate having her around. My daughter's fiance is actually a filmmaker, so when they're around, I can talk movies with them, and I feel like even though they're young, we can have an intelligent conversation about films, which isn't. We have fallen off the movie here for a bit.
One of the things that stood out for me in the film, where there was certain sequences where I did feel the cinematography was beautiful for what he was trying to do. So you get used, there are, from a historian perspective, where I'm like, I wanted to see this to see, you know, what was his early stuff like. You get to see some of the visionary filmmaker in this. And that part's worth it for watching it through. You know, if you kind of divorce yourself from the story and just start taking a look at some scenes that are shot where you actually see the environments, there's some beautiful environmental setups in this that I thought I was like, wow, that's a stunning shot. I wish I liked the people more. But
honestly, this may be horrible to say, but I almost think this movie could be improved by watching it on mute. And interestingly, Kubrick had intended this as a silent film, but then he had to put in the soundtrack, which ballooned the expense. He was going to make it a silent film in 1952.
Right.
And this is one that I think would be hurt more by colorization than most other black and white films, because the cinematography is the standout aspect. We get the performance of the girl. We should specifically call out, it was Virginia Leaf who gave that performance. So she gave, I think, the best performance in the film. And the cinematography has moments of exceptionality that the storytelling doesn't have. So I don't know. This might be a short one, but I think before we get to the ratings, the one other thing I want to say is I think. I actually think that there's two groups of people we can recommend this to. We've already recommended it to those who want to see film history or Kubrick's history and see how films are put together in the growth. The other group I would recommend it to, if you are familiar with Kubrick's later films and you're suffering from a bout of imposter syndrome, put this in. And
it took a second for that to hit me as to what you were saying. I find that to be a very amusing thought.
Yeah. So you can look at this and go, okay, this is where Kubrick started. He wasn't firing on all cylinders his whole career either. So.
Yeah, I guess. Well, I think realistically, like I said, I appreciate your comparison. But I think we are talking about the same group, really. I think we're talking about people who are interested in film history and want to see how somebody can develop and how somebody can produce this. And by produce, I don't mean the traditional producer, but you know, as a director and film creator, how somebody could create this film and then go on to make something like 2000. You know, I think that that's the aspect that we're getting to there.
I will say there were certain aspects of the score that, like, especially as we got to the end where we got to the crescendo, that I thought went along with it nicely. I actually am going to echo Blaine's point, though. It's like if you'd taken out the dialogue and maybe just had the score there, it would have worked so much better. Because I think you're onto something. I feel like the wooden performances, which is where I started, because that really stood out for me. It was like, please stop talking. Because I felt like every time, you know, the leads both on both sides, you know, you figure like the general and the lieutenant, like they should be the ones that are rallying me. It was the opposite. It was like, shut up, which you don't hear me say. But I felt like musically the score, like there were certain sequences, I'm like, oh wow, that kind of stood out to me. And you don't hear me say that a lot. I thought that the score did a nice job of adding some emotion, because I wasn't getting it anywhere else except for the girl. And I will agree totally with Trey's point that I think Frank Silvera was bringing it home at a certain point in time. But I felt like the problem with it being only him in that crew for me was that we got the two guys that are doing the assault on the general, and I should be caring about them. And it was really, again, it was all about like, this guy's sacrificing himself. I want to see him survive, but I don't care what the other two are doing. And that was the part that I think hurt all of that. It wasn't him. It was, I needed the other part of this scenario to be motivational for me. And that's where it fell apart. But I did the score. I'm not pretending to be a score expert, but I will say it stood out for me at certain points in this film where I'm like, oh wow, that was good. Similar to the cinematography.
But it's worth noting the composer is Gerald Fried, who was working right up until his death in 2023. He passed away in his 90s. This is not his best known score. I think we'd all be familiar with it. I don't even think I have to name it. So if I did that any justice, he scored 4 episodes of the original Star Trek, including a mock time.
That's cool.
Yeah, that is, and that is a very memorable score. That's virtually everybody's favorite Star Trek clip.
Theme, yeah.
Yeah, he also did 51 episodes of Gilligan's Island, which is where John Williams got his start as Johnny Williams before he went on to Lost in Space. Reed did 2 episodes of Lost in Space, 6 of Mission Impossible. So, yeah, he did Roots. Oh,
there's no questions. You know, you don't want to criticize somebody for their beginnings. But, you know, you see what the quality of the work is and you see where they progress to. And that's what I keep coming back to on this. And I feel like I'm a broken record a little bit saying this is seeing development of Kubrick. And it's going to be interesting as we move on from this to see the movies that are in between this and 2001. And I know that because I do listen to your podcast, I do know there's a little bit of a debate on 2001 and where we're going to go on that. But to see the confidence level and just the control over what we're seeing and how it develops. I think it's going to be interesting as we go through this particular filmography. And I don't know if I want to go as far as use the word urge, but I would suggest that people kind of come along with us on the ride, because I think it's a, if you're a film fan, I think this is a fun way to look at these.
In fact, for Kubrick, I think we are two films away from what I think is his most mainstream film and his first great film. So, and the next one, as a boxing film, there's a good chance Paul will like it more than I do.
Very possible. But I guess, you know, we are short, and I apologize to the listeners if we're selling you short here, but, you know, it is what it is. I also don't want to drone on about, you know, saying the same thing over and over, which I kind of feel like I've been doing a little bit of. So I think we could just rate this. And quite frankly, I think I have two ratings and neither one of them is high. The first one is if you're watching this for entertainment, in which case I think it's a Jaws 4. I think it's a bad movie for entertainment. I think it's that simple. I just don't think it's entertaining really on any level for just sitting and watching. However, if you are watching it from the perspective of filmmaking and seeing that purely as an exercise in history, I think you start getting to a high Jaws 3. It's not something I'm going to want to watch over and over again for historical purposes, but I'm kind of glad I saw it.
It's... So I was thinking low Jaws 3 all week walking into this one, and I'm going to pull that back and actually go with where I'm at. It's a Jaws 4. And what I'm going to say, building off of what you were saying there, Paul, though, sometimes it's saying this is a Jaws 4 that's worth seeing if you're a film historian, you know, and you want to see it for that purpose, seeing what happened with this one. I think it's a Jaws 4 with, I would say, the girl's performance is a Jaws 2, you know, as far as she, you know, carries the film at that point. I would add some of the sequences with Mac being the same thing, but as a whole film, it's a Jaws 4. I was almost pulling my teeth to get through to the end of it, and that's again for an hour long film. It's like it felt like a 4-hour movie for me, and we've covered films recently that have been over the 2-hour mark where I was like, that flew by. And I think there's something to that. And so for me, it's from my personal feeling, it's a Jaws 4. And but I'm glad I did it for this podcast, and I'm glad we're doing this series. So thank you very much for suggesting this series. And I'm glad I saw it for this reason.
Yeah, there is something that feels so wrong about giving Kubrick a Jaws 4 for one of his films. And it is worse to be boring than to be bad. So I'm almost right at the line, but I think I'm on the Jaws 4 side.
If it makes you feel any better, Trey, I think Kubrick gave it a Jaws 4.
Well, yeah, true.
Yeah. Well, Kubrick also gave 2001 a Jaws 3. He was never happy with his work. But anyway. So I'm the one that suggested the Kubrick series, and I did it because Kubrick is one of my three favorite directors of all time. And this is Jaws 4, right? The cinematography is there. That one performance from the girl, I might even argue it's a Jaws 1. Matt's performance is a Jaws 2. There are standout elements in this, but not enough to carry the film above that Jaws 4 line into the Jaws 3. Mm-hmm. And that's something coming in from the first time I watched this, I figured, okay, I can check that box and I'm done with this film. And then this is probably going to be the second and final time I watch this.
Yeah, I don't see myself revisiting this.
There's just not that much here. So again, if you are interested in filmmaking and cinematography, it's worth watching with low expectations just to see how one of the masters started. But if you're just here for the cinematography and you're going to watch one Kubrick film, this ain't it. We're still getting to those.
And we will.
Yeah.
So, and unfortunately, you know, with the Kubrick movies, we don't get to go to Where's Alfred? So, you know, we'll move on from there. What is the next thing we're going to cover on this series? And that's, you know, counting both Hitchcock and Kubrick movies.
Actually, I was going to sort of mention both. So the next Kubrick, because we're doing his in chronological order of release, is Killer's Kiss, since you've already done the short films. This is another short feature, boxing story from 1955. And I think that's really the last of what I would call his student and growth films. And then he starts firing on all cylinders. So that's, I think that's the last of the ones where I'm going to be going, is this, you know, Jaws 3 or down? I'm going to be, okay, is this Jaws 2 or up? But before we get there, we have three Hitchcocks to get through. The first of which is going to get a much higher score from at least Paul, probably all four of us. Mm-hmm. Next up is North by Northwest.
I've heard of that one.
So we'll actually have North by Northwest, Jamaica Inn, and Rope before we get to Killer's Kiss.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, I just missed for a second. What was the middle one of the Hitchcock?
Jamaica Inn.
Okay, that's of the three, that's the one I'm unfamiliar with. So we'll see where that takes us. But in the meanwhile, first we'll do North by Northwest, which I am very familiar with. I hope you'll all join us. And if you're not familiar with North by Northwest, I would suggest that you make an effort to watch it before we do our review, because I believe it's totally worthwhile to do so. And I know I'm giving away all of my my thoughts already, but so be it.
Yeah, but it's also Hitchcock's longest film at 2 hours and 16 minutes, making it a little over double this. It feels like it's maybe a quarter of the runtime of Fear and Desire.
That's not necessarily positive.
Well, I mean, I don't think this spoils anything for anybody, but let's all be honest. It has probably one of the top 10 great film sequences of all time in it, right?
It is certainly reputed as such.
Yeah, that's... You know, we can tip our hand a bit.
As to whether or not everybody agrees with that or not, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who has seen that film that I've discussed it with who would rate it below Jaws 2. Let's put it that way. So North by Northwest is coming, and it will be a nice change after Fear and Desire.
I look forward to that, and I thank you guys for coming on with us to do this. As always, it's always a pleasure and always an interesting conversation. So thank you, and thank you everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Girls always love stories, but it's so hard to finish and wait for words.
You want to hear more? Do you? All right. Then the spirit, magician's power, goes back to the island and tells Miranda that her father's dead. The spirit sings how he's dead at the bottom of the ocean. His bones are coral, his eyes are pearls, and Miranda, her father's dead. Dead? Can't you understand anything? Dead. 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 Now do you understand?